Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Lyle Wagner Building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Commissioner Tony Mercer and Rob Floyd. Tonight's topic, not a movie, but one of the greatest TV shows of all time.
All time.
Batman, the series.
Sweet.
So, Commissioner.
Chief O'Floyd?
Whatever.
I got nothing. Yeah. I got nothing at all.
You recently just got the Blu-ray box set.
I did.
Which is amazing.
It's amazing.
Is it everything you hoped for?
Actually, yes, it is, as a matter of fact. Now, as you know, for many years now, at pretty much any convention that you go to, you can buy the bootleg DVD set of Batman, which is, somebody recorded episodes off air, probably originally on videotapes, and then transferred those to DVD, so I'm sure they looked phenomenal. But
but it was the only thing that was available for so long.
Right, and I've wanted this series at my fingertips for so long.
Oh, yeah.
That pretty much every convention that I've been to, and you'll remember this for I don't know how many years now, I almost buy the bootleg Batman DVD set.
Yeah.
And then I don't because I say, the minute I break down and buy that bootleg, they're finally going to announce...
But think of how sooner it would have come out if you would have bought the bootleg years ago.
Sorry, world. It's all my fault.
See, that's why I'm waiting for the Green Hornet to do that. Because I do have a bootleg DVD set. And it is the one of the few things on DVD I have bought that has not come out soon after I bought it.
Yeah, you know, that is true.
I broke
true.
The curse, I guess.
I remember when you bought the Logan's Run TV series...
Yes, I do.
At a convention on bootleg DVDs, and then like a month later, they announced that.
Yeah, and
it probably wasn't a month later, but it was close.
It was
enough.
Soon, and Super Inframan.
Yeah.
Same thing, you know. But tonight we're talking about Batman.
Yeah.
Or we're trying to. And to point out, this is kind of interesting. We're actually recording this, the day we're recording this. I saw on the Facebook, our friend Josh Watson posted that today is Burgess Meredith's birthday.
Sweet.
So, top hats off to him.
Happy birthday, Mr. Meredith.
Yeah.
Wherever
you are. Who was amazing as the Penguin.
Yeah.
You know, that was one of the cool things about this show is you got these top-notch, real actors showing up on here and just doing these goofy characterizations. It's like we just watched a Cesar Romero episode recently here, and you see him in any other thing, and he's this Latin lover and a big, I mean, stature, big man.
Mm-hmm.
And you could not picture him playing the Joker and jumping around and hunching over and that laugh and then the makeup being as silly as he is when you see him in something else. You know, I mean, he just... totally immerses himself in the character. And I don't see Cesar Romero when I watch the show. I see his Joker, you know?
Except for the mustache under the makeup.
Well, yeah.
Which you can now see in crystal clarity thanks to the brand new Blu-ray. But hey, you know, taking a step back.
Let's do that.
I kind of want to talk about... Now, we only have one rule on Phantasmo After Dark. And that is, there's no rules.
I was going to say they have to be over 18, but go ahead.
Well, you know, that's Phantasmo After Dark After Dark is what you're talking about.
What happens in the lounge stays in the lounge. But there are no rules.
There's
no
rules. Do what we want.
Do what we want because we're grown.
But it does say cult movie podcast.
Yes.
On the label, that's what it says. It
doesn't say and much more.
So I gave about, it does. Much
ah,
more.
Loophole.
Yeah. Well, no, this is going somewhere. Bear with
me. Okay, I'm with you.
Because of that, I gave about, you know, 3 seconds worth of thought to, you know, if we should say something to sort of justify this choice. Because not only are you dealing with a television show, which is not a big deal, you're dealing with something that was a huge cultural phenomenon, massive popular hit. Not a cult thing necessarily.
No, but it pretty much started pop culture almost. I mean, with the explosion of merchandise and the fan base, the rabid fan base of it at the time, I would guess say bigger than the Star Trek fan base.
Yeah, well, I would say that and the Beatles.
Oh well, yeah.
But anyhow, so. the answer to the question of, you know, should we justify the choice is, of course, no, because there's no rules here. And it says much more.
That's right.
But that train of thought got me to, it led to, you know, what I think is maybe an interesting place anyway.
All right.
Which is, it does feel somewhat like a cult thing. And to me, it does.
Yeah.
Even though it clearly isn't, because it was a, you know, huge popular success. And I think that if it has any kind of cult status at all, it is a question of its ongoing reputation over the years and who...
Oh, yeah.
Who... in our lifetimes, anyway, has professed to appreciate it or denounced it, and sort of the backlash against it over the years, and then the sort of resuscitation of its reputation that seems to have happened in these last couple of years, and the build up towards this home video release. Because in the time where when we were growing up, of course, it was ubiquitous on television. It was
The reruns whenever a station would decide to run it. It wasn't like Lucy, which has been on a station every day, anywhere in the United States. Yeah. Batman would show up every couple of years. I remember when I was real young, it was a big deal that the station was going to start carrying it as, you know, in reruns and syndication. And because I'd never seen it before. You know, I'd seen pictures, I guess. But seeing the commercials for it, and I was just blown away as a young kid, probably like kids were in the 60s when it was first going to air, and just, you know, in wonder, like, I have to see this show. It's Batman. It's going to be live action. And I was not disappointed when it came on. As silly as it was as a kid, you don't see the silly as much as, you know, you do as an adult. You're just like, all the color, and it's Batman, and it's live. It's not a cartoon. It's not a comic. He's right in front of me. And, you know, I still watch it today with that kind of not the exact kind of wonder, but, you know, you just love, you want to see the costumes on screen as much as possible, moving around and doing stuff. And the color, which we'll get into about in a little bit about the difference between the three seasons, how that changed over the course of that. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the sense of wonder about it is what keeps it going as far as everybody growing up watching it as a little kid, and as they get older, you know, they still have that.
The key thing is, and this is not an original observation by any stretch, but the key thing, I think, in its appeal, particularly to, you know, to us when we were that age, is when you're a little kid, you don't know it's a comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's colorful. You know, there's superheroes, there's honest to goodness supervillains, which is a big deal because there were, you know, several superhero shows of, you know, of different stripes on television when we were growing up, live action shows.
Yeah. I mean,
you had Wonder Woman, you had
Spider-Man.
Spider-Man. Of course, you know, the Hulk, you could definitely count $6 Million Man as a superhero type show.
And even the George Reeves Superman show before Batman.
Yep.
No supervillains.
Right. So $6 Million Man is really, well, you had a couple of flirtations with a supervillain type character in Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Wasn't there... There was some sort of anti-Hulk or evil version of the Hulk.
Oh, there was the one episode, yeah.
And $6 Million Man, you had the Bigfoot robot and, you know, a couple other things.
Yeah.
But by and large, there were no supervillains on these shows, no costume villains.
Nobody from the source material, from the comics.
Going, as you said, all the way back to the George Reeves Superman, which was always gangsters he was fighting. And you know, that was one thing that was definitely missing from all of those shows. And to a certain extent, the action. I mean, the action sequences, the way that they're staged and as sort of chaotic and exciting as they are on screen in the Batman show, you don't really have anything like that in any of those other shows that we named. So you've got all the color and all the costumes and the honest to goodness villains that are recognizable, you know, from the comic books and whatnot. The action that we mentioned and all that excitement, adventure, and you don't process it as a comedy. As a matter of fact, we were watching the Blu-ray the other night, and Kim asked me, we were watching the episodes in order. We were in the first season.
Oh, okay.
She said, labeling everything, because, you know, everything has yeah. a sign on it.
The bat this, the bat that.
She said, do they stop doing that eventually? Is that a first season thing? Because I don't remember that. I said, no, it's one of the core gags from the show.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I don't remember it. And I said, well, how long has it been since you've seen this? Have you seen it since you were a kid? And she goes, no, that's right. That's what it is. It's just been too long. I said, no, it's not that it's been too long. It's just that when you were a kid, you didn't think anything of it. Yeah. Of course, everything's labeled. That's the bat pole.
Yeah, you know? That's how you know what it is.
That's right.
Because it's labeled.
Assuming, of course, that you weren't so young you couldn't even read the label, which is another possibility. But the point of all this is that while, yes, the show is a comedy, it plays to a child as a superhero adventure show.
Well, because they play it straight and there's no laugh track.
Yeah.
The jokes and the comedy comes out of it being played straight and dry.
Right.
And for the adults that are paying attention to it.
Right. So it doesn't prompt you for the laughs.
Yeah.
And that's a good point, because it's probably one key reason why, you know, kids don't pick up on that element of it. You know, beyond the fact that at least early on, a lot of the humor is reasonably subtle. Reasonably subtle. Relatively subtle, let's say that. That would change as the show went on, of course. But,
there's the blatant, gosh, gee, Batman.
Yeah.
Golly, you know, that super straight lace stuff that's like, oh my God, that you laugh at. Even in the first season, I mean, the first episode we watched, there's quite a bit of that. Batman and Robin being such squares about everything that makes it funny.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But when you get older, you begin to realize, you know, and it doesn't take long. I mean, you know, one good dose of bat shark repellent and the awakening begins.
Yeah.
That this is a comedy, that they're having fun with the material, let's say. And then, you know, once you get into your teens, especially and particularly if you're a comic book fan, and especially and particularly if you're a comic book fan in the 80s.
Oh, right, yeah.
In a you know, post-Frank Miller world,
mm-hmm.
it's not cool to like the Batman TV show anymore. That's not Batman. They were making fun of Batman.
Yeah.
That's not the real Batman. That's just, you know, that's some silly comedy, you know, crap. That's not the Batman that I like, you know. And then there's this thing that I think a lot of comic book fans go through, you know, if they stay with comics their whole life, this thing that they go through that they really need to and hopefully will eventually grow out of. Unfortunately, some of them don't. Where if you are an adult or an adolescent, especially if you're an adolescent,
mm-hmm.
that likes entertainment that was designed or perceived by the mat culture en masse as being designed for children. Instead of being mature enough to say, yes, it was created for kids or it's a comedy or whatever the case may be, but, you know, I get something out of it. It's entertaining to me. I enjoy it. It makes me happy,
mm-hmm.
and I'm comfortable with that. What you begin to do is say, no, look at this can be dark, and look at these serious themes, and then you want that so badly that you begin to demand that the material reflect it. Unfortunately, and man, I'm already on a tangent, aren't I?
Sorry. Yeah, keep going. It's good stuff.
Unfortunately, what happened in comics is that a whole generation of comic book creators grew up on comics thinking that way.
Yeah.
So when they came into the business, they started making the comics that way. You know,
mm-hmm.
and for a while it was cool. And for a while in the 80s,
well, when it was new and unique and
before
different,
before it went too far,
uh-huh.
and before there was no alternative,
and before everybody and their brother is doing the same story, same book, same stuff,
and the default mode of comics becomes grimdark, as the kids say today. it was all right, but after a while, not so much. I probably don't need to go too far down that path.
No, because that's a whole nother conversation that I will get passionate and irate about.
Yeah, the point is that it's not cool past a certain point for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's not cool to like the show anymore.
Yeah, well, it wasn't, but I think it's come around that everybody likes this show for what it was at the time. For the time capsule of pop culture that it is. I mean, even Adam West at one point, you know, well, he milked it for all he could in the early days after the show, going to car shows in costume and all that stuff. But I think he kind of put it behind him a little bit from what I remember. And then when the Keaton movie came out, of course, he kind of put down anything that was Batman that wasn't his show. You know, but now he's even come around that, hey, it's everything's great. You know, it's all good. I did it because, like he said in that little documentary thing, we did the show to make people happy, and I like to make people happy, and it was a fun show. And I think it's come around a little more that most people, like you say, that at the 80s and 90s, you know, it was grim, gritty stuff, it wasn't cool to like it. But now I think it's more that a lot more people do and admit to liking it. Because it's just one of those pieces of Americana.
Right. Well, there was a long time. I mean, that show informed the perception of what superheroes and comic books were in the mainstream outside of, you know, comic book fans for a long time. And there was a long stretch of years, decades even, where any, if you were to see a small article on comic books, whether it was comic book creators or comic book fans or some movie or television property adapted from comic books, it would always be biff, pow, wham, comic book swing into action on Wonder Woman Saturday nights or whatever. You know, that's what it was. You couldn't really read an article or a reference in the mainstream about comics that didn't reference that Adam West show in some way. And that, I think, is another reason that the backlash happened, because not only comic book fans, but comic book creators wanted the material to be taken more seriously than biff, pow, wham.
Yeah.
And for everyone to sort of behave as if that was the default mode of every comic book. And I can understand that.
Oh, yeah, I get that. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's not us. That's not what we are, what we're about. But if you go back, and we've had this discussion before, and look at the Batman comics at the time the show came out, say from the, late 40s through the 50s up to the early 60s, the comic was like that. It was ridiculous. Batman going back to dinosaur time. You had Jungle Batman, you know, Batman in space, the mini Batman costumes, the rainbow suit, the pink suit. I mean, you know, there was so much ridiculous stuff. And adding to the Batman family with Batmite and Batwoman and the original Batgirl in the red dress. And they even, I mean, Aunt Harriet and Alfred was a completely different character at the time. And just so much of it was silly and kind of goofy in the comic at the time. People forget that.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, one of the things that informs the backlash against the... let's just call it Batman 66 to be clear.
You know, that's the catchy.
That's what people are calling it these days, right? One of the things that informs the backlash against Batman 66 over the years is the received wisdom of the comic book fandom / Batman fandom.
Yeah,
and by received wisdom, you know, I mean information that you have acquired. From others and taken as, you know, fact or sage wisdom.
Oh, yeah.
The informed wisdom of the Batman fandom tells us, and there are people in high places who have helped shape Batman in different media over the years. I'm talking about Danny O'Neill. I'm talking about Michael Uslan and people, Uslan, whatever his name is, people like that, who have perpetuated this because it's all based on their memories more than it is on the actual material.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the received, and there's a lot of received wisdom in comic book fandom generally because unlike today, where you can you have pretty easy access to a lot of vintage material.
Oh yeah,
you know, we live in a golden time as far as that's concerned because, you know, if you want to read Golden Age Batman, if you want to read all the Silver Age Marvels, if you want to read all these classic comics, it's available. Not only is it available to you, it's available to you in multiple formats. You can get it digitally, hardcover, softcover, whatever you want to do.
Yeah,
you can
collections get this stuff at your fingertips.
But for decades, that wasn't the case. If you didn't have the money and the luck to find these old school comics, the only things that you knew about the old stories were modern comics referencing old stories, which of course was a big thing.
Or if you were lucky enough to get like a 100-page giant that had a couple reprint stories in the back,
or just talk around your, you know, comic shops or your friends or, you know, whatever area you grew up in, you know, that conventions, whatever.
Yeah.
So all of this, you know, forms the received wisdom, and the received wisdom of Batman says that in the 40s, Batman was he was the Dark Knight detective. He was grim and he was gritty. It was very noir. It was rooted heavily in the old pulps, like The Shadow and The Spider and things of that nature.
Yeah.
That it was serious. That in his early days, Batman even carried a gun and would kill criminals. That the vision of Batman that later fans would covet, that really becomes entrenched with the Frank Miller and Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah, well, I mean, Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill brought it back to a point in the 70s.
That's what he says, and that's why Denny O'Neill is partly responsible for this received wisdom. Hang on, we're getting there.
Okay.
Is that, you know, that's what Batman was. Very serious, very straight, very dark. All through the 40s, he was the Dark Knight detective. And there is some truth to that. He was very much a pulp noir, you know, detective hero in the spirit of The Shadow and The Spider and pulp heroes of that nature for a few months.
Yeah.
For a few months.
Oh, yeah, for just a couple of issues, really.
Yeah. Well, for a stretch of issues. It lasts...
Until Robin
less than a year.
Yeah.
Less than a year after Batman debuts in Detective Comics.
And he only carried a gun for, about two or three issues, really?
That's right. And Batman in Detective Comics, those stories were mostly eight-pagers because it was an anthology.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, sometimes they would have more than one Batman story, but the stories were typically eight-pagers. Was popular enough after a while to warrant his own book, which was very common in the 40s. That's how it would work, is that heroes would be introduced in anthology series.
Yeah.
And if they were breakout, they would get their own comic. So Batman number one debuts, again, less than a year after, I don't remember the exact timing, but it's less than a year after the first appearance. And in Batman number one, we have two very important introductions.
Yeah.
The Joker and Robin.
And wasn't Catwoman in that also?
And Catwoman, you're right.
So three.
So three, yep. Catwoman's in that one too.
But she was just a cat burglar with no costume.
She wasn't really the Catwoman we think of now. Not yet.
That was just a nickname for this cat burglar.
Right. And later she would get this huge, like, cat mask.
Yeah.
Right? Like basically a big cat head.
A mascot head.
Yeah, right, that one.
And an orange dress
mascot
and a red
head.
Cape.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So as soon as Robin is introduced, it begins to lighten the Batman story.
Which that was even in Detective.
Immediately. Now, I will say this. In the first appearance of Joker, he is pretty, I mean, he does pretty much come off like a psychotic killer. He's pretty scary.
Yeah, actually. I mean, there were dark moments in some of these early stories, to be sure, but it wasn't the dark, gritty, grim stuff like the first few issues in Detective. Once Robin came in, like you said, it lightens things up, but the Joker is a dark villain, regardless.
Yeah, and another thing that isn't really discussed about those very early, you know, grim and gritty stories is they're kind of dull. they're a little dull. Not all of them. It depends on. I mean, now we didn't know they didn't know this at the time, but now we have, you know, reasonable scholarship on who wrote what. So the Bill Finger, and God, we could go on long tangents about this. I'm going to try not to. The Bill Finger written stuff is typically interesting. The Gardner Fox stuff, while I like the guy and some of the other things that he's done, boring. But he didn't always have an affinity for every single character he ever wrote. Depends on what he was doing. He was more of a science fiction guy. I digress again. Point is, with the introduction of Robin, the Batman stories begin to get lighter. And they would always have, I mean, for a long time now after that, they would have, you know, elements of darkness to them, don't get me wrong, but that lightening of it begins early and continues quickly to evolve until, still in the early 40s now, you have a Batman and Robin that are grinning ear to ear while punching out villains and trading puns.
And both trading puns, not just Robin.
Right, not just Robin. I mean, you know, so much of what goes into Batman 66 is informed not even necessarily by the really wacky stuff in the 50s, but by
just the tone of the book,
the 40s comics.
Yeah.
A lot of it is in there. I mean, the narrator in the show, so much of the things that he says, you can definitely see the parallels between the title page, introductions and narrations in those old 40s stories, particularly the Bill Finger stuff, okay? And Bill Finger is widely considered to be, you know, Batman's best writer in that era, and for good reason. Like everybody else, I didn't have a chance to read those stories until much later in life.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've been collecting those Batman Chronicles trade paperbacks, which have all the
Batman
stories in chronological order. And so it was really reading those was really where I began to discover this. When you read those introductory captions on the title pages in those old stories, you can hear the Batman narrator from the television show. You can hear him in your head because it just fits. Right?
What's this?
You know, up to and including the fact that some of the stories were actually adapted from comic books.
Yeah.
Some of which went all the way back to the 40s. So, you know, does that mean that the comics of the 40s were exactly the same as the episodes of the show? Well, no, of course not. They heightened it. They made it more of a comedy. It was definitely self-aware camp comedy. That's what it was intended to be, and that's what it was.
Yeah.
But they didn't have to heighten it that much. You know,
the
story goes that if I remember this correctly, hey, drinking game.
Okay.
I just said if I remember this correctly.
Taking a sip.
Right. It was the success of the Superman, Adventures of Superman, Lone Ranger, that stuff that inspired folks or motivated folks to want to do another superhero show of some stripe.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the Batman serials more than anything.
Oh, because they re-released those too.
Yep.
In theaters.
That's right. And it was those that inspired producers to want to start looking at maybe optioning Batman for a show. And when William Dozier was eventually hired to produce it, he went and got himself some Batman comics for research.
Yeah.
And when he read them, he said, now remember, it was the serials that inspired the germ of the idea to do the show.
Which were not tongue-in-cheek at all. They were just straight
crime
stories, but the detective wore a Batman suit, more or less.
That's right. But when Dozier read some Batman comics, and I have no idea if he just went and got some off the rack that were contemporary, or if he went back and got some old ones, or what he did. I have no idea. But when he read the comics, he said, reportedly, according to the legend, that you really can't do this straight, that we've got to do it as camp comedy. Because if we do this, this, you know, without doing it in a sort of knowing, comedic kind of way, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that is the sort of quote that drives comic book fans and Batman fans crazy. Well, what do you mean that you, and I can't speak to the man's taste, okay?
Yeah.
Could it have been that William Dozier could have read Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns and walked away from that saying, I can't take it seriously and we got to do it as a comedy? I guess that's possible. I have no idea. But what I'm saying is that if he read any, you know, Batman comics, say after 1942 and before New Look, in the early to mid 60s, don't really have a problem with that, honestly.
Yeah,
taking that and saying, I can make a comedy out of this. You know.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you read some of those old issues, and you get the way the Dick Sprang stuff with the big props. You know, the Joker has a giant typewriter, and they're fighting with, you know, and these huge, enormous, you know, roadside attraction looking type of props and things.
For our non-comic book fans out there, and for our non-comic book historians out there, yes, Rob just said Dick Sprang.
Yes, I did.
And yes, it was the man's name.
And yes, that's, it's not a euphemism.
That's awesome, but please continue.
But, you know, he was responsible for if I'm remembering right, the big props that appeared in a lot of the issues, the oversized, huge, giant penny or T-Rex, you know, the stuff that ended up in the Batcave, but all that other stuff that appeared a lot in those issues, and also the classic Joker look that everybody seems to remember with the overly pointy chin and the super high cheekbones and the long pointy nose. Mm-hmm. And the perpetual smile, which in the early days he wasn't a fixed grin.
Well, I say the smile started a little earlier than Spring, which you can see.
But his look of it is that classic look.
Yeah. Well, so I think a lot of the things that I'm not up on this enough to pinpoint exactly what, but some of the things that I think are most associated with Spring predate him. It's that he perfected them.
Gotcha. Okay.
I honestly don't know if the giant prop thing begins with Sprang.
It just seems to be always associated with his stuff.
Right. Well, very briefly, just to give this some context, Bob Kane is credited as the creator of Batman.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spend a lot of time telling the story of how Bob Kane should, at the very least, be sharing credit with several other people
yeah.
for the things he gets credit for creating. Look that up on your own. It's a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm.
But Bob Kane used ghosts.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of the time. And a lot of the artwork that signed Bob Kane over the course of the 40s and 50s was actually drawn by other folks. Two of the primary ghosts, there's three, Jerry Robinson, Sheldon Moldoff, and Dick Sprang.
Mm-hmm. Now, isn't Robinson, if I'm mistaken, more responsible for the final look of Batman, the costume? Because I saw something not long ago, I want to say, where the original look that Kane conceived, he had a red Union suit and more of actually bat wings instead of a cloak cape.
I'm not sure about that.
Now, okay. That's something to look up, folks.
I wonder if I don't know. I wonder if Bill Finger made some suggestions about what to do differently.
Might have been Bill Finger.
Bob Kane didn't really write any of the Batman stories.
Yeah.
The earliest Batman stories and a lot of the most iconic ones were written by Bill Finger. It's another thing to look up on your own because we could spend a whole podcast talking about that.
Which we're kind of starting to do.
We are, aren't we? Hey, man.
Let's see if we can segue this back to this show and away from the comics. It's Russ Tangent time.
Yeah.
Take a drink. But anyway, go ahead and finish that thought if I didn't derail that train.
What was I on about anyway? Oh, I think I was talking about
Kane not responsible
just
for
in
all
case,
the writing.
Yeah, well, just in case anybody was actually interested in the thought I was trying to finish. Rob.
I'm hanging on your every word.
Don't fuck with me, buddy. I do the editing. I'll cut all your shit out. It'll just me be talking about comics for an hour. It'd be awesome.
I'd listen to it.
So the point I was going to make is that I don't know if the giant prop thing begins with Sprang or Moldoff or Kane.
Yeah.
But Sprang was best at it.
Yeah.
And he's most associated with it because he introduced a lot of really dynamic force perspective type mm-hmm. stuff into his Batman strips over
yeah.
the time. Whereas Moldoff was good, but he was happier but he was more content to just sort of mimic Kane's stiffer style.
Yeah.
Sprang did a lot more with it. So anyway, in the 40s, it's not as grimdark as its reputation. In the 50s, the Batman comics go just ape shit, and you
yeah.
start to get stories about Batman swapping places with aliens and, you know,
yeah, and
all
going
kinds
into
of,
space and going back in time and the jungle Batman and
yeah, that's all kinds
American
of
American Indian Batman and Batman's many nations.
And then in the 60s, they, you know, what the Batman books were not selling well, and they tried to revamp them. That's where the so-called new look Batman comes in with the mm-hmm. yellow oval. And
that was Infantino, wasn't it? Didn't he come up with that?
Yeah. Well, the key change there is that they switched editors. They gave Batman to Julie Schwartz.
Oh, well, Julie Schwartz. Yeah. I mean, you know, Mr. DC for the longest time.
Yeah, and Schwartz he had the Flash and Green Lantern and the Justice League, and he wasn't really doing, you know, pulp hero,
yeah.
Urban crime stuff. I mean, his books were
science fiction,
suburban sci-fi utopia kind of
yeah.
look and feel to them. And he had Infantino do Batman and, you know, redesign the costume and all that. And I love Infantino when it comes to The Flash or Adam Strange, but not right for Batman.
No.
But and I'm going to get off this in a second, but there is an interesting point here
okay.
in my mind in that if it was a contemporary comic, assuming that he didn't pick one up years and years before,
mm-hmm.
like if the pre-production on Batman started years and years before it was actually released, if Dozier grabbed a comic off the spinner rack that was contemporary, you know, just went into
yeah.
the soda fountain and got one or
yeah.
whatever, it would have had to have been a new look era Batman.
Yeah.
So it would have been one of these, you know, sort of brightly lit, very straight and dry
mm-hmm.
Julie Schwartz era books. Which is that strikes me as odd, because if that's what he was reacting to,
yeah.
to make the Batman TV show, that's an odd jump. So that leads me to speculate that's not what he was.
No, I think it had to have been either I think he got some older books from somewhere, because if you look at, and I don't know if it's on that Blu-ray set or not, but I know it's on YouTube, Adam West and Burt Ward's screen test for Batman, the original screen test, the costumes are different from what ended up on the show. The bat suit.
Yeah, the bat, it looks more like the...
It has the black...
The pre-new look.
Yeah, the big black bat with no, you know, moon, yellow moon behind it, or, you know, that it's in, and the longer ears on the cowl. Which they couldn't get to stay up for some reason. Yeah. And the Robin suit is slightly different. I think it's got more
laces
across the front or something. It looks slightly different. And I do believe I don't know if the screen test they did with Lyle Wagner, who actually did audition for Batman, folks, before Adam West.
And that would be, if you're not familiar with the name, Steve Trevor from the Linda Carter Batman show.
Oh, and
Linda Carter Batman. Linda Carter Wonder Woman show.
I was going with you. I knew what you meant.
Yes.
And also regular on the Carol Burnett show.
Yeah. I hope he was more entertaining on Carol Burnett than he was on Wonder Woman, where he's just a big plank of wood. And as a matter of fact, his screen test is one of the extras on the new set.
Now, is that the screen test as Bruce Wayne or in the bat suit without the cowl? Oh, both? Cool.
Yeah.
So you get to see him in the bat suit.
Well, you see him, you know, it's a scene from the pilot, and you see him and whoever else, I don't remember who it was that was playing Dick/Robin in those scenes, but they're, you know, up in the mansion, and they go down, or in Stately Wayne Manor.
Yeah.
And then they go down to the cave, and they're wearing the costumes. And then they've also got the Burt Ward, Adam West screen test, where they do the exact same scenes.
Okay, so that is on the Blu-ray.
The exact same lines. Yeah.
Okay, we're watching that after we finish recording. All right. I need to see that in good quality.
Well, be careful what you wish for, because the Wagner screen test is terrible. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And look, it's a screen test. Lord knows they might have memorized those lines like 10 minutes before they went on.
But the charm doesn't come across.
No, but I mean, there's no struggle trying to figure out how they picked West and Ward over the other two, because Wagner just clearly does not get it.
Yeah.
Whereas Adam West, it's still a little rough around the edges, but and Burt Ward, but it's really good, and it's much more in the spirit of it. He pretty much got it right away.
Yeah,
and Ward too. Ward is light years ahead of his competitor in the other screen test. So
yeah,
but anyhow,
yeah. Well, what I was getting at with that is you can see the costume they had for the screen test is the pre-new look with the, you know, so I'm guessing they did look at old material, old books to draw from, as well as the current what was on the stands. And I think that's, I don't know if it was DC or the producers of the show that said they wanted the new look for the costume, because that's what was in the books now, the yellow bat, the yellow circle.
That's ringing a bell. I heard that
somewhere.
Yeah.
But let's jump into the series. Yeah. Let's talk about that some. Now we've had our prologue. Now part two of Phantasma After Dark talks about Batman 66.
Stop giving me shit. I'll cut you. I swear to God.
I don't want to hurt you. I just want to cut you a little bit.
This whole episode will just be me talking and you going, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. Really?
Uh-huh. No, you're just having me saying the intro and then at the end. Well, that's all, folks. We'll see you next time. Like, I got up and went out for pizza, and you just kept on doing the podcast. Which doesn't sound like a bad idea, actually. Pizza would be good right now. But pizza wasn't on the Batman show.
All right, TV show, go.
Okay. Well, we watched the first episode a week ago. And you can see the first episode, just like any series, the first episode of the first season haven't quite found the ground of what you fondly remember of the show. The tone and the way things are, the conventions that they set. But a lot of it was there. A lot of it was from Ground Zero. But the tone of the show was a little darker in the first episode than it got to be.
Well, I would say straighter.
Well, straighter, yeah.
I wouldn't call it dark.
No, not dark. But he does mention that his parents being murdered. And you never hear that ever again in the show. His dark origin, the angst of when she, you know, from when he came.
But key point here, you don't hear it a lot in the 40s either.
That's true.
It just comes up once in a blue moon.
Yeah.
The origin story, which was initially, I believe it was just one page, right? Wasn't it just one page?
Yeah, it was. It was about
in its first
four
version,
or five panels.
I think they expanded it later, but in its first appearance, the origin story was, and was one page, and it did not... It was not published until several stories in.
Yeah.
Right. And aside from that, and then a revamp of it, and then certain key things like the Joe Chill story in the comics, where Batman confronts his parents' killer, didn't come up.
No,
on that. That you know, this you know the daddy obsessed Batman that comes up later.
Yeah,
you know, but
anyway, but in the show you only get that in the first episode, and that there's a reason for him being Batman. Later on, he's just you know the do-gooder Boy Scout Batman. That we love and remember from the show, you know. I don't think many people. I didn't remember that from the first episode until we watched it again.
I remember that they mentioned it once. I didn't remember where and what the circumstances were. I just remember probably just because I've heard it said that they mentioned it once.
But I mean, what an episode to open with though, with Gorshin as the Riddler,
yeah,
and Jill St. John is his henchwoman Maul. And then Burt Ward trying to act like Jill St. John in a Robin disguise, which was just hilarious. But the bat gadgets you get in that, you get the bat anti-theft device on the Batmobile. And what else do we get in that? Because we got the Batarang climbing the building.
Well, you get the Batusi right off.
That's right. That was where the Batusi, the dance craze they were trying to start happen. But yeah, the thing that was revolutionary about the show, and you get it in the first episode, you get... I don't know my television history that well before that, but it was a two-parter show that ran on consecutive nights.
Yeah.
It was the first episode was on Wednesday, and the second episode was on Thursday. Nothing like that had ever been done before.
No, I don't think so, no. Uh-uh.
And it was a cliffhanger, the first episode. So you had to watch the next night to find out what happened.
Same bat time,
same bat channel, which wasn't said at first.
No, it took a while for that to catch on, but or become a staple, I should say. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think that's such an important. It was a great move to make it serialize it, to make each story, at least in the first two seasons, a two-parter, and to put it on different nights, whether it be you know every other night or a week apart or whatever. The key thing here is that it's a half hour. And then another half hour to tell a complete story. And why I think that's key is because, you know, I mentioned earlier the other superhero shows from the 60s and 70s, you know, your Wonder Woman and your $6 Million Man and your Incredible Hulk. And all of those shows have, and honestly, I would say a lot of 60s and 70s, particularly 70s, especially 70s, adventure television shows have this problem in that it's essentially half an hour's worth of story stretched out over an hour.
Yeah.
Padded,
oh, yeah.
Padded. Oh, yeah. You know, it afflicts all of those shows. It's so common. You know, when you go back and watch Wonder Woman and $6 Million Man, it's as though, and I don't know what credits they share, but it's as though they were made by the same people making the same mistakes in some ways.
Well, you know, Wonder Woman was made by, I think Stanley Ralph Ross had a bit to do with that, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, there you go.
I'm not sure about $6 Million Man, but I know,
So to set it up as two half-hour parts.
Yeah.
Get in, get your get your setup, get your gags in, get your action in, and move on.
2 minutes of recap.
Right
at the beginning of the second episode,
as opposed to long, dull stretches of nothing with nobody in costume and no action happening, which is what you get an awful lot in all the other shows.
Oh yeah. You would get a lot of those shows, and even I want to say a lot of I haven't watched many of the superhero shows that are out now, or but even some of the movies, the TV shows in the 70s were notorious for. You would have, if it was an hour show, barring commercials, we'll just say an hour, you had probably about 50 minutes of the character out of costume, story padding, boring, and maybe 5 minutes of him in costume the entire show.
Yep. Even Adventures of Superman, which I do like, the George Reeves show, which predates.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Half hour doesn't have the hour padded affliction that the later stuff has. Half hour, mostly self-contained episodes.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot of Superman in them, and never any supervillains.
No, right? No.
You typically get two brief appearances, in costume appearances per episode, was how the formula would work. So right off the bat, with the Batman show, it differentiates itself because you get a lot of damn Batman and Robin and the villains.
Maybe 5 minutes of Bruce Wayne, Dick Grayson, throughout both episodes.
Right. And it's interesting because for me, I enjoy Adam West generally, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot about that as we go along. But his Bruce Wayne,
it's great.
It's so great. He's so suave.
Yeah, you
know, he's so cool. And the little bits, it's funny because the little bits of Bruce Wayne that you get, and he's so good at, you know, as Bruce, it almost leaves you wanting more Bruce. It's which is good. That's good, though. It's good.
One of my favorite parts.
It's better
parts.
To be sitting there going, gee, I could use even more Bruce scenes because those are so great, but now let's get back to Batman, than it is to have the reverse be it where it's like, geez, I only got a little bit of Batman.
Yeah, which is odd, which is so odd. But one of my favorite parts in the Batman movie, the 66 movie, is when the villains capture Bruce Wayne and take him back to their Wharf lair, and he starts fighting and tries to look like he's not really fighting, kind of. But Adam West nails it, man. Yeah. I mean, that is one of the best scenes in that movie.
So we're talking now about the feature film that they made that sprung from the series.
Yeah.
And my favorite bit with Adam West in that movie is the Miss Kitka scene.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Where Catwoman is in a civilian disguise as Miss Kitka.
And, the Russian reporter or
right,
something.
Right, right. And Bruce Wayne goes back to her hotel suite or whatever, and she's trying to seduce him. And you know, Wayne's wearing a nice tuxedo. And I remember watching that not too long ago and saying to you that with having watched that scene, I desperately wanted after that to be able to see Adam West do a Matt Helm style.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
Spy series.
Yeah.
Like a tongue in cheek spy series from the 60s, because seeing him in
he just wore the tux. He worked the tux. He didn't
really
wear
did.
It. He worked the tux.
Much like,
and I said this before, I'll say it again, Robert Wagner in Heart to Heart. I think he could have done, he's probably one of the few other people that could have done a good that type of Bruce Wayne at the time. But Adam West, though.
Yeah. So in those early episodes, and as you alluded to earlier, the in the first season, it's always funny. I mean, from the very first season, you get Batman walking in full costume into a nightclub and dancing with Jill St. John. Yeah. Okay, so it's always got...
But his line is, the guy says, "Table near the front, Batman?" Says, "No, I'll just walk to the bar. I don't want to seem, I want to be inconspicuous, or I don't want to draw attention." That's
right,
what he says.
Right. But relative to where the show would eventually go, it's straighter. It's a little straighter, a little drier than it would, than it would later become. And, you know, you mentioned also earlier about how Batman and Robin were always squares and they were, you know, delivering these moralistic messages all the time. But early on, especially, it's really cool because I have this dual reaction to it when I watch it, when I watch Adam West specifically deliver some of those lines, where I feel like at the same time you go, "Oh God, that's hilarious." And yeah, you tell him, Batman.
You teach him a lesson, Batman.
And that's just West handling his business, man. He was so good at that. He was so good at being so cool and suave, but also utterly square and guileless at the same time.
And playing it so straight that he wasn't nodding and winking to the audience. Mm-hmm. He was believing what he was saying and making you believe it.
Right.
You know. And you're right. Yeah. I mean, that's a testament to him as just an amazing actor or an amazing, I mean, he just, maybe it was just the right part for his style of acting or something, but it's gold.
Yeah. And I would also give credit to the writers on that front, because I think, or the creative folks, I should say, behind the scenes, because I would speculate, and this is speculation, but I would speculate that, in that time, in that place, if they were doing, a show about costumed characters getting up to hijinks and a lot of action and fighting as they were doing in that show, they would have been required to a certain extent to have put in moralistic messages for children. It would have been expected of them, and if they hadn't done it, there would have been trouble. I mean, you hear stories about all the censorship concerns and the complaints that the show did get.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's all the infamous story about the Catholic League of Decency complaining that Burt Ward's bulge was too big in his shorts. Okay. So I think they would have been required or expected on some level to put those moralistic messages in there. So to have put them in there in the way that they did, you know, so that, hey, they're good moralists. morals, especially early on, they're good messages for kids. Like I said, it's that simultaneous, yeah. Oh, that's ridiculous, and yeah, Batman, at the same time, yeah. Right?
Now that really came along more in the 70s, though, and especially with the Saturday morning cartoons. There's a fantastic book, which I think I let you borrow and forgot I let you borrow it.
Yeah, you let me borrow it, and I forgot to actually read it, yeah.
But I forget, it's something Saturday morning, I forget the name of the book, but it really talks about how the weird hero cartoons of the 60s, Herculoids, Space Ghost, not so much Space Ghost, but and stuff like Herculoids, Johnny Quest, people died, they were a little darker in tone, there was no message, no moral, it was just an action show. And when the cartoons in the 70s get here, everything is a lot lighter tone. There's not as much fighting, action fights, and pretty much everything had to have a moral or, you know, a milk drinking happy ending to it. But I think the Batman show, like you said, was a bit ahead of its time, or maybe they did it on purpose to kind of sidestep some of the other stuff. Because there is a lot of dry adult humor in it that's not overt. And a lot of stuff that they tried to slide by, like some of the foreign names. There was one where, I forget what it was, I'll have to look it up, but one of the characters' names was something or another, and the censors wouldn't let him use it. And it was an actual foreign word for something, but it sounded like something else. So they made up a name that actually sounded dirtier, but since they made it up and it wasn't a real word, I think what they used an actual foreign word for a four-letter word, English dirty word. And so, no, you can't use that. I was like, nobody speaks this language. You're not going to get it. No, you can't use that. So they made up a name that just sounded dirty, but they let that go by because it was a made-up name, you know? But as the show goes on in the first season, it starts to lighten up quite a bit more. And in the second season, we were talking, is pretty much what most people's recollection of the show is.
Yeah.
Just the balls-out colors and music and the silly puns and the over the top. Gosh, Batman. Gee whiz. You're right.
Yeah. Well, the second season would seem to be the sweet spot, I think. The show has always looked good, always had great color. But they clearly spent some more money and put some more thought into the production design in the second season than they did in the first, because they were a hit and they could, you know.
Oh yeah.
So there you go. But the first season, as I said, it's a little straighter and drier, and it's also a little more static, a little bit. The use of lighting and the colors, the production design, the camera work all gets more interesting in the second season. Also, the comedy gets ramped up, but it doesn't tilt over.
Yeah.
You know, it just gets, just turn the hysteria knob just a little bit more, you know. But it doesn't tilt over into just, oh God, this is ridiculous and sort of painful in the way that it kind of does in the third season, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, we for those of you that weren't sitting here with us in Tony's living room about an hour or two ago.
You mean the Phantasmo Lounge?
The Phantasmo Lounge. No, we were watching in the living room. We went up to the Phantasmo Lounge to record.
Yeah, you're right. I'll cut that out.
Yeah. Anyway, we watched the I don't know if there was a Jump to the Shark episode. The classic episode, the surfing episode in the third season, where Batgirl came in the third season. That was really the reason to watch the third season, but she was barely in this at all, but the scenes that Yvonne Craig was in as Barbara Gordon in that amazing bathing suit.
Oh, good Lord.
Were phenomenal. But the ridiculousness of that episode of Batman, Joker, instead of doing a crime, a real crime, he kidnaps the surfing champ of the beach so he can be the surfing champ and get all the glory and adoration of the locals and all that. That was his big motivation of this episode. Just to be a surfing champ and get everybody to like him. And then Batman challenges him to a surfing competition. So that won't happen. Instead of arresting him for kidnapping the guy and taking him to jail, you know. And when they go to change into their surfing trunks, they just come out with the trunks over their costumes.
Yeah.
I mean, total ridiculous look to it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's not even so much a question of the plotting and what the gags are, I think, that make it different and not as good as what you get earlier. It's just like you could tell they were spending more money and putting more thought into it in the second season. You can tell they're spending less money and putting less thought into things in the third.
Oh, so, yeah. Well, one prime example is there's only one. Are they even in the Batcave in that episode at all?
Yeah, briefly.
Okay, so they're briefly. Well, they already had those set. They had the Batcave. They had the Wayne Manor set. But the only other set you see in this episode is the inside of that bar, the Hang Five. The rest of it is on location, on the beach, the entire episode. And that was free. You didn't have to spend any money on that. Except the one where they go, I don't know if it's in the Hang Five, but they crash through that window that's just kind of a window suspended in the air.
Yeah.
There's no walls or something.
Well, it's not even necessarily that it looks bad. It's that, although I understand that there's episodes from that season where there's, you know, windows hanging in space in front of black curtains and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's not even so much that it looks bad. It's just there's a certain verve that's missing from it, and you can feel it. And it's sometimes difficult to put your finger on exactly what it is. The lighting isn't as interesting as it is in the second season, for one thing. Really, it's the same thing, and we talked about this earlier, that it follows the same trajectory as Star Trek does, the original Star Trek. In the first season, it looks great. The stories are a little drier, a little straighter.
Yeah.
In the second season, it looks even better, and the lighting and the camera work gets even better. And it gets
Shatner's hair piece looks better.
Actually, I like first season Shatner.
Do you really?
Better? Yeah, I do.
I have to go back and look.
And see in the first. Oh God, this is really nerdy. But in the first. Especially in the first half of the first season, he's got that real high and tight military.
Uh-huh.
And he looks better that way. But by the time you get to the third season and he's got the shaggy late 60s, early 70s, shave your damn neck bill hair. Oh,
yeah.
God, I can't stand that. But all that's getting cut out. Nobody needs to know that I sit there and give a shit about Shatner's hair
season to season.
And I really do, people. I really do.
No, you're leaving that in. you try to say, no, this is really nerdy. Have you listened to any shit we've talked about on the last three or four podcasts?
No. Well, my wife can tell you, like, we'll sit down and watch third season Star Trek episodes, and I will just pause and start just bitching at the screen. God damn it, Bill, cut your hair. I hate it.
Look, you are to Shatner's hair like I am to costumes and props, okay? You know how picky I get about that shit.
Oh, God.
You know? That's not the one they were using in that episode. This one was built by so-and-so. I mean, you know.
I'm mortified right now. Anyway, so what were we talking about? Okay, so it's the same trajectory in the second season of Star Trek. Things get, actually, in a lot of ways, I prefer the first season, but the second season has a lot of the episodes that are the ones people remember best. Trouble with Tribbles, for example. It gets funnier.
Classic stuff.
It gets funnier. It gets poppier. It gets a little more swinging, you know.
Yeah, than, and that stuff stands the test of time
the
more
season,
than the other
which
stuff.
Which is a straighter, you know, more straighter science fiction approach. And again, it looks really good. Then you get to the third season, where the budget's getting slashed, and they brought in Fred Freeberger, and Gene's not really in it much, or is not as hands-on as he had been. And you know, partly the stories suffer. I mean, this is where we get stuff like Spock's brain and whatnot.
And the surfing Batman episode is the Spock's brain of the Batman show.
The look of it, I mean, the sets get cheaper, and the lighting is not nearly as beautiful and dynamic as it was in the first two seasons, which it might not even be a question of, well, the Enterprise sets. I mean, the location or the alien planet sets are definitely cheaper. The Enterprise sets don't look any worse, but they're not lit as well, so they seem to look worse. And there's all these other sort of little changes. The costumes change.
Yeah.
And you can't put your fingers on any one thing and say, okay, that's what did it. But the whole thing, it just has this sense of missing something and just being different in a bad way.
Yeah, almost like it's an afterthought, or they're just kind of like, they're just kind of...
And I think that's
riding on
seems to be the same thing that happens to Batman in the third season.
But yeah.
But with that said, those episodes, at least the ones that I've revisited so far, they're thoroughly entertaining.
Oh yeah,
much like many of the third season Star Trek episodes, they just don't hold up to what came before. Yeah. That's all.
I got one thing to say about that. Batgirl.
And then there's that
because
Yvonne Craig makes many things that are bad good.
Yes, she does. It was a smart move to bring her in. I mean, it wasn't like bringing Cousin Oliver in to save Brady Bunch, you know. and, you know, no offense to Robbie Riss there, but, I mean, you know, Batgirl, it was from the comics. She was in the books. and it was a great addition to the show. It did revive it a little bit, and she was lovely to look at.
Yeah.
And more color, because they made her costume that shiny, spandexy, sparkly purple, which the show was all about color.
Yes, and tight, you know, very tight.
And tights, yes.
And there really is something about, I don't even know how to phrase it. I never know how to put this. Is it 60s glamour? I mean, call it what you want. But there are beautiful women in film and television in every era, film and television.
Oh God,
and,
yes.
You know, pop culture in generally. But something about the 60s, man. Something about the 60s. Yep.
Something about the style, the way the women carried themselves by being sexy, but not like they were trying to look sexy.
Yeah.
They just were.
Well, as much as I appreciate something like a Mamie Van Doren in a cashmere sweater, which,
and who doesn't?
Which is a lot. You know, there's a very exaggerated sexuality in that recedes somewhat in the 60s.
Right? Yeah, it was more of a smoldering undertone of sexuality. And we've said this before, prime example of that, Barbara Bain in Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like the gold standard, I think. You look at any episode of that she's in, and it's just smoking. Something behind her eyes, something by the way she carries herself, you know. And the style, the fashions were just, you know, really cool. And in a nostalgic look back, you know, and also just because they were. I mean, they were appealing.
Yeah, it's hard to... Like I said, it's difficult to even articulate, much less put my finger on, but there's just something. I mean, and I guess it's a little bit of everything, the fashion, the time, certainly the fact that, you know, we're dealing at a point now where, you know, in every era, the women that you see in film and television are going to be beautiful, and they're not necessarily going to be representative of every woman that you'll necessarily see on the street. It's heightened, obviously.
Yeah.
However, relative to what would come later, there's a realness, a humanness to the beautiful women in film and television in this era that unfortunately we don't get. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's, I guess because it's not on display to be sexual. Example, you look at Charlie's Angels in the 70s. Whenever they were in a bathing suit, you know, on the show, which was a lot.
Yeah.
They made sure, the camera made sure you saw them in the bathing suit.
Yeah.
They were posed, and it was the shortest, you know, skimpiest bathing suit you could get away with on television, and they were in it a lot in the camera's face. This episode where Yvonne Craig is in this one-piece bathing suit, but it has this fishnet panel in the front with this bow right over her cleavage, but you still see the cleavage enough. And she's just sitting there enjoying the sun, watching the surf, smiling. It's not overtly sexual. It's not put in your face, but damn if she's not sexy in that scene.
Well, that's, you know, that's Batman, and that's a concession to what you could do in a show like that on television at that time. If you go to like another great representation of beautiful women in the 60s is, of course, the Bond girls.
Oh,
yes. And you know, in the filming of the Bond girls, you're going to see something much more reminiscent of what you were describing with the Charlie's Angels situation.
Well, yeah, but that's movie and TV.
It was probably a difference of what you could get away with in television in one era versus another. I mean, it's still a valid point, but that's specific to Batman or something on television, I would say. In the 60s, generally, it's harder to define, but I will say it definitely has a lot to do with you had women in that, hell, I would say right up into the 80s, really, that were sex symbols that you couldn't even imagine being, you know, famous in that regard now. I mean, I was watching on the Warner Archive, on the streaming Warner Archive, I was watching this god-awful TV movie from the late 70s starring Suzanne Somers. The less said about that, the better. I don't even remember I only watched half an hour before I couldn't take it anymore. And Kim's giving me a dirty look from across the room because of the pain it caused her to sit through half an hour of that movie. But the point is, you've got Suzanne Somers, who at this time was a big sex symbol.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a beach movie, and she's in her bathing suit, and she's surrounded in this thing by beautiful women who are also in bathing suits. But when Suzanne shows up in her one piece, all the men go ape shit in this
all
movie
hits turn.
As if they've never seen anything as gorgeous and sexy as Suzanne Somers.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here watching it, and I'm thinking, there was a time when Suzanne Somers was a sex symbol.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah. And I think about that. She's not, in many ways, she's not what you would consider conventionally or traditionally beautiful, frankly.
But you go back and look at Three's Company when that was on. And of course, they were pushing her to be the sex symbol.
Right.
And she was in skimpy outfits and she was a bleached blonde and she was attractive, you know. But yeah, by today's standards, things are so much different. You have like we were talking about earlier, the heroin chic, and everybody has to be pencil thin and almost have a boy's figure instead of a woman, womanly curved figure. And there's a certain look to the facial look, like you say, that wasn't. You look at Suzanne Somers, and back then, you're like, she was a sex symbol. You know, by today, she wouldn't be, but back then, yeah.
So, yeah, 60s, awesome. Women, good.
Yeah, Batman.
But Batman, Julie Newmar.
Do we have enough time left? I mean, good God. She was a goddess, okay? Any excuse to get her in that Catwoman suit on the screen, she should have been in more episodes. The one that we watched a little while ago, we were talking about that extended chase scene where Batman is on one level, Catwoman's on the roof above him, and they're just running, and he's chasing her, and she's running above him. And I think you're right when you said the reason that scene went on so long was to get her butt on camera as much as possible in that suit running. And it was glorious, and I'm thankful that we watched it.
We are thankful. And she's hotter than Hellfire and sexy as all get out.
And a great comedic
actress.
Wears
that costume like nobody else could. Yeah. And key thing here, just as, and you've already said it, great comedic performer.
Oh, yeah. Her timing, the little subtle things did. Yeah. There was the one part where she goes to sit in her throne all sexy and regal, and she kind of trips a little bit and stumbles, and the way she kind of looks like nobody saw that.
Yeah, there's so many things. And just in the story that we watched, there's so many little comic touches that she does. You're sitting there thinking, okay, she either ad-libbed that, which is genius, or she made that look like she ad-libbed it, which is genius.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just excellent. Really great.
And you talk about a sex symbol.
Yeah.
Oh, she was just smoking. Everything she did was sultry.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like overly trying to do it like a lot of stuff you see today. It's like pushing it in your face.
Well, it's not
it just flowed out of her.
It's not vulgar.
No.
Ever. And it is very sexy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's right out there. I mean, she's wearing skin-tight outfit, swishing her hips.
Wearing it well.
Yeah, and somehow manages to make it not...
Yeah. And it could be
It's not Maxim magazine. How about that?
No. It could be the campy, tongue-in-cheek nature of the show that holds that in check, maybe. It could be.
Well, it might have been that demanded it of her, but I would say, it isn't the comedy surrounding what she's doing that keeps it from being vulgar. It's just the way she handles herself.
Yeah. You know? And no offense to the Eartha Kitt fans out there, but Julie Newmar was the Catwoman.
No contest.
Now, Lee Merriweather in the film did a great job, but Julie Moore kind of just set the standard.
Yeah. Well, the three of them are playing three different flavors of...
Yeah.
Catwoman. They're not really the same character. Yeah.
Her Miss Kitka, like you said, was enjoyable to watch. Yeah. Every second she was on the screen is Miss Kitka because she was smoking.
Yeah.
Her Catwoman, you hit on the head, was just a different version, different take. Good thing it wasn't the mascot head Catwoman from the early comics. And a little side note, I had, fortunate enough, I had the opportunity to meet Lee Merriweather again earlier this year in the Williamsburg Film Festival. And she was a delight. Just was it this year? Or was it last year?
Last year, I think.
It was last year. Yeah. and she's just a super nice person. Fantastic. So much fun to talk to. And did I ask her about working on the Batman film the whole time we were there? No, I did not. When I finally got a chance to talk to her alone, for about a good half hour, 45 minutes, what did I ask her about? Batman? No. Barnaby Jones? No. Being Miss America? No. I asked her about Match Game and Battle of the Network Stars. And she talked to me. She went, oh my goodness, I haven't thought about that in years. And then proceeded to talk for about a half hour or so or more. And it was delightful. She was fantastic.
So now we've named three things that Rob and or I really tend to nerd out about. One individual each, and then our unified dual obsession.
That's right.
So for me, Bill's hair and Star Trek.
Yes.
For you, costumes and superhero yes. movies, TV shows, whatever. Yes. For both of us together, Battle of the Goddamn Network Stars.
Which we may have to do a little 2.0 podcast on that, because talk about pop cultural time capsule. And I can relate a little inside dope on that from The Horse Is Mad, Lee Meriwether, who was in the thick of it. I got a couple of good stories from her about that. But back to Batman and the TV show itself. I mean, we'll get into the movie a little bit more as we keep taking side trips. But Julie Newmar being the Catwoman of the show and setting the tone and the pace. Two more villains that were played by multiple actors. The Riddler, who Frank Gorshin, first episode, amazing choice to for the first episode.
Yeah.
I would have picked the Joker if it was me, but using Gorshin and what he did with the role.
There's shades of Joker in Gorshin's Riddler,
though. Oh, there is. He plays it a lot more, yeah, like the Joker in a way, all the maniacal laughing all the time.
Yeah.
But he made it his own, you know, made it his own character. And then you go and you get the episode, which I have not watched in years. I don't know about Gorshin, if he wanted more money or he was had another project going, but he couldn't make it.
Yeah, probably just busy.
As he was working. He was a working
man.
I
know that's why Newmar wasn't in the third season as Catwoman, because yeah. she was doing something else.
We get Gomez Adams himself, John Astin, playing the Riddler. Completely, totally different take. Probably closer to the book, the comic. Not as maniacal. More of kind of a... I'm not really a smart ass, but here's my riddle. Figure it out, you do-gooders, you.
Yeah. With all, and again, just like Julie Newmar is a definitive Catwoman, Gorshin is a definitive Riddler. With all respect to John Astin, of course.
Yeah, amazing actor. I've seen him do other thing. I saw him, I want to say, do a reading as Edgar Allan Poe, reading The Raven in makeup and all, and it was amazing. So far removed from Gomez, who everybody associates him with, you know. But definitely, his Riddler left a lot to be desired.
Yeah.
It didn't quite fit with the show. Even him trying to do his, you know, his big Gomez maniacal eyes, it just wasn't Gorshin.
Yeah, but that's one of the. I mean, as you said, the show was peopled with strong established character mm-hmm. actors, and that's probably one of the drawbacks of having your show being peopled with strong established character actors, is that they're busy and they have other work, and if between seasons they get hired to do something else, which I think is exactly what happened here,
probably, and the show has to go on.
And
the thing about it, the first season, once it became a hit, then everybody and their brother wanted to be on the show.
Yeah,
and you got huge names on the show. Let's get real quick. Let's hit the other villain that was played by three, much like Catwoman, I think, was played by three different actors. Wasn't it Mr. Freeze,
yeah.
And you had, who was the first one?
George
Sanders, and then Eli Wallach.
Yeah, how about that?
Eli Wallach playing Mr. Freeze. And who was the last one?
I don't remember.
Oh, geez. Okay, we got to find that out. We'll edit that back into this right after I said it. And the three actors were... But let's go down the list, which I just have in my head, and I'm not looking at on an electronic device here.
Nope.
But aside from the reoccurring standard cast, I mean, Cesar Romero is the Joker. I think we talked about that earlier.
Yeah.
Just amazing what he did with it, knowing and seeing the other straight work that he did. Never would have thought of him as the Joker, but man, he did something with it. Burgess Meredith, always a joy.
Love Burgess Meredith.
His little asides, his little talking under his breath,
seemed like
ad libs were just remarkable.
Yeah, the Penguin.
Yeah. And you've got, I mean, actors like Victor Buono, Ann Baxter, Vincent Price. Jeez, let's see. It goes on. Carolyn Jones, Cliff Robertson.
So Gomez and Morticia both appear in Batman, everybody.
Yeah, Uncle Milty, Eartha Kitt, Don Red Barry. Jeez, let's see, David Wayne.
So that would be Son of John, David Wayne.
Yeah. Rudy Valley, Glennis Johns, Jock Mahoney, Lynn Peters.
Actually, no, I'm thinking Patrick Wayne.
Patrick Wayne, yeah.
I always do that. What was it?
Who I was going? I was
what,
letting
we
you
were go. Talking about that the other night when I was made a joke about David Wayne being Sinbad in the 70s or something. Cutting that out. Anyway.
Though I'd like to see that. oh, God. James Brolin was on an episode. No, three episodes. James Brolin, Terry Moore. God, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. All these people that show up. And some of these are just in one episode. Ethel Merman. When Ethel Merman is a villain in your show, that might be... Is that third season? That might be the jump in the shark season.
I'm just wild about Batman.
God, Gary Owens, repeatedly, is a voice on the radio. George Firth. Okay, George Firth, for those of you who may not know, I love seeing George Firth on camera. Character actor, 60s and 70s. But George Firth, to my mind, will always be the guy in Cannonball Run doing that poem when he meets Farrah Fawcett against the cannonballers. The automobile, and then the, was that Terry Bradshaw and Miltels rev up their car and it blows the windows out and knocks him down. And he's always just getting crapped on by him the whole movie. But George Firth, one of those faces, you've seen his face somewhere. Woody Strode was an episode of Batman. Norman Alden, very important in comic book history. He was henchman number one in two episodes of Batman. Norman Alden was also Frank, who ran the Electra Cave and Electra Woman and Dinah Girl, and he was the voice of Aquaman on the Super Friends. Sid Haig did an episode of Batman. Otto Preminger is Mr. Freeze. Did we say that one?
Otto Preminger was one of the...
Otto Preminger. Yes, that's what right, I was looking for. That's why I was going down through this list.
Yes. Yep. Director Otto Preminger.
Otto Preminger was friggin' Mr. Freeze. Shelley Winters, Art Carney, Van Johnson. But yeah, Otto Preminger, Eli Wallach, and...
George Sanders.
And George Sanders. Three Mr. Freezes. And did any of them distinguish himself from the other as Mr. Freeze?
And I have to rewatch the other two, but the George Sanders Mr. Freeze is kind of boring.
Yeah. Oh, here's another thing I meant to bring. Oh, Victor French turned up as one of the villains. Rob Reiner had a cameo as delivery boy on one episode.
Delivery boy.
Yeah, delivery boy number one, apparently. Let's see, what was it? Bob Hastings, who figures into Batman lore later on, played Major Beasley in one episode. Now, Bob Hastings, you may ask, who was Bob Hastings?
Who is Bob Hastings?
Bob Hastings, one episode of Batman 66, later on was the voice of Commissioner Gordon on Batman the Animated Series for however many years that was on. So he stayed with the Batman family for a long time. And there's many other character actors. Buck Cartillion, who was a big in Planet of the Apes. He was Julius. And he was the Wolfman in Monster Squad, the TV show. But anyway, long list of things. Long list of people, but just going through to show you how many name actors of serious reputation over the years came in to do this little campy TV show. And they're talking big movie star actors, not TV actors, not B movie actors. Just this is how much of the impact the show had on the time, the cultural landscape at the time. Which I was trying to get at a long way going through that list.
Well, I mean,
it was a phenomenon.
Yeah, it was a huge, huge hit, at least for a little while. It was a big smash, and all those people were in it because everybody wanted to be in it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they came up with the window cameos.
Oh, window cameos.
To accommodate famous people who were like, hey, I want to be on.
Yeah, and they didn't have, well, we can't write a whole episode about you. We've got enough episodes, but we'll stick you in here.
Hey, everybody, it's Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah, Sammy Davis Jr., Henny Youngman. Before Green Hornet and Kato did the crossover episode, I think they popped out of the window one time. God, who else showed out of the window? Jerry Lewis did one, didn't he?
Yeah, Jerry Lewis did one.
Yeah, all kinds of people showed
Colonel
up.
Colonel
Klink. Yeah, as Colonel Klink. We're talking about trying to find Colonel Hogan, not to mention that it was, what, 20 years after World War II, and he was still looking for Colonel Hogan in Gotham City. Okay, let's do this. Here's a fun little thing. Okay, well, your favorite villain on Batman, say of the traditional comic book villains that they had, you know, Joker, Catwoman. Who was your favorite to see?
That's tough. That's really tough. I struggle with picking a single favorite anything most of the time.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
But, you know, my favorites, because there's a lot of, you know, villains that have appeared, even name villains from the comics that are not among the core villains that showed up over and over. So you're talking Joker, Penguin, Catwoman, and Riddler.
Yeah. It's hard to pick out of those four.
Because beyond those, you've got, you know, Mad Hatter and Mr. Freeze and various others. And then, you know, villains they created just for the show.
And we're going to get into that in a minute. But the core four. The
favorite would have to come from the core four for me. And I find it very difficult to pick between them. I think if you really twisted my arm to make me narrow it down, it might be a tie between the Penguin and Catwoman.
Yeah.
The Julie Newmar Catwoman specifically.
And she's just a joy on the screen.
She
every
really
time.
Is. And I like Burgess Meredith in general. And for some reason.
I'll watch him in anything he's in.
The Penguin. I mean, and I like the Penguin character. From his very first appearance in the 40s, he's a fun character. And he was a deliberately and clearly comedic character.
Yeah.
As I talked about in the 40s comics, there's a lot of comedy and puns and silliness, even when the stories themselves are, you know, straight capers. But the Penguin stories were always meant to be sort of charming little comedies, the way that Bill Finger conceived them.
Yeah, and Burgess just takes it to a different level.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, he totally makes it his own, and he's forever associated with it after that.
Yeah.
From the Penguin walk.
Yeah,
that it was just so hilarious to watch him walk. Like I said before, my favorite hit, those little under the breath things he says.
Yeah,
his little asides to himself, they're just hilarious.
Yeah. So I would say probably those is the tie between those two. How about you?
I'll probably have to agree with you. I mean, though I'm a huge Gorshin fan.
Yeah.
You know, and he's a joy to watch on the screen. I guess it just depends on my mood. But Catwoman, Julie Newmar's Catwoman, yeah, any day of the week. I'll go with that. I'll go with those two. But like I said before, watching Cesar Romero, I'm trying to see Cesar Romero when I'm watching him do the Joker, and I just can't do it. I watch Ocean's 11. He comes in as, was it Big Duke Slater or whatever his name is in that? Duke something. And he's this big, huge, imposing, suave kind of ex-gangster guy. That's not the Joker jumping around in that outfit, silly. It can't be the same guy. And then again, Gorshin, just maniac over the top, you know, maniacal, but just to sit down and watch, and enjoy the performances anytime they're on. Yeah. I'll go with Penguin and Catwoman. Now, not core four. Okay. We'll go with comic book villains, but as well as the ones that they created for the show. maybe your favorite out of those and you're just absolutely least favorite. Cannot watch. Will not watch the episode.
I don't know if there's any can't or won't watch least favorites.
Or just cringeworthy.
I don't think any of them offend me that badly.
Well, I'll tell you one. I'll tell you one that I like that I didn't like as a kid watching it.
What's that?
But I enjoyed it. King Tut.
Ah, yeah.
Victor Buono is King Tut. I did not like it as a kid watching it, but now going to just watching him, you know, his performance is fantastic. It's almost like the Burgess Meredith. And what he does with it and his little asides and how he plays it. It's a lot of fun.
Well, I got to give it to Egghead because Vincent Price.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah.
Vincent Price.
That's a class by himself, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Vincent Price. And he's also one of those guys that can go kind of like Roddy McDowell, I think. And I'm not saying I'm not saying this about the Batman show. But he can go from playing A-list material films, feature film A-list material, to doing B-grade pictures that are pretty much crap and doesn't hurt his reputation, goes right back to A-list pictures type of thing, but always gives it 110% in either role, whether it's goofy, over-the-top Dr. Goldfoot or, you know, more serious horror fare, The Fly, or even the Corman stuff where he, you know, the Corman Poe stuff. I mean, Roddy was the same way. But yeah, Vincent Price, class by himself. I was not a big fan of Shame, the Cliff Robertson cowboy character. That just kind of bugged me. Even though he does a good job with it. Now, I think you did say one of your least favorites we were talking about a week ago was Milton Berle.
Yeah, yeah. Not so offensive. I wouldn't watch the episode, but you know, the whole let's come up with a generic gangster because Bilton Berle wants to be on the show when there are so many other possibilities. Not so much for me, I would say.
Yeah. I have to go with Uncle Milty. That and Nate, I did enjoy Liberace as Chandel. Seeing Liberace playing a villain. And of course, his equally villainous, I think, cousin or brother, who was a gangster, and it was a tough guy, and talked like this, not at all like Liberace.
But not his brother George.
No, not his brother George.
I wish my brother George were here.
But inspired making Liberace a villain on the show, who at the time was mega popular.
Yeah.
You know, now let's where we're talking favorites here. Favorite bat gadget.
Oh boy.
let's narrow it down a little bit, okay? Favorite bat gadget from the utility belt. I know mine.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I feel like I should pick some
other than bat shark repellent.
Well, I was about to say, I feel like I should
that's universal.
Pick some outrageous gag instead of something very basic and utilitarian, pun intended. But
just something that was cool to you personally.
The plain old batarang, man.
Of course, it was awesome, and everybody wants one.
Yeah, the plain old batarang. Yeah. Just to see it. Just to see a real working one. Well, yeah. You know what I mean. It's a prop.
Well, yeah, but to see it in 3D physically in front of you.
And the cool you know, effect they did to make it look like he was quickly climbing up the bat rope.
Yeah. You know? Oh, when they pulled him up on the wire.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, that didn't look cool.
It didn't look bad at all. And they did it. Didn't they do it twice in the first two-parter? Or was it once in the first
one, once in the second? Watching the first season in order, they do it several times in the first season. Yeah.
Cool. I got to say, the batarang is a given, you know. And prop geek, okay? I don't know if you ever noticed, but the Batman, Robin, and Batgirl's batarangs were slightly different.
I know the Batgirl one was different.
The Batgirl and the Robin, I think, are pretty close to the same, just different colors.
Yeah.
Hers is purple, Robin's is blue.
Yeah.
But the Batman batarang was actually half again bigger than the Robin batarang and folded, where the Robin batarang didn't fold. And it was slightly different shape too, where Robin's was more rounded, the Batman batarang was angled, and I'm geeking out on that right now. See, it comes back around. My turn now.
Yeah.
This is my Shatner hairpiece moment. and I'm not ashamed of it. I'm owning it. but no, my favorite bat gadget other than that had to be the bat shield. First time I saw that as a kid, I forget what episode it was. Maybe it was a Penguin episode, and they're getting ready to shoot a ray or shoot guns, and Batman reaches in behind his utility belt and pulls out this little piece of plexiglass that has hinges and fold, and he unfolds this thing into like a shield that he and Robin can hide behind. And it doesn't bend or move, and the bullets are bouncing off of it, and he pulled out of his utility belt.
That's damn handy is what that
is. It is damn handy, but it looked cool. It had the bat scalloped edges going around it, and it was clear with, I think, blue and yellow trim, and said bat shield on it, in case he forgot that was the bat shield, you know? But I love it. I would love to have one.
You know, you mentioned Robin a couple times during this discussion.
Yes.
And I really do. I want to talk about Burt Ward.
Let's do that
for a minute, because we talked about how great Adam West is.
And yeah,
he is, man. And I don't mean he's good for that kind of thing, or, you know, there's no qualifiers or caveats on it. He's just good. He's good. Damn it. Okay. But
you're saying he's good.
I'm saying he's good.
Okay. Make a note.
But if I had to describe Burt Ward in this series with a single word, it would be game.
Game?
He's game. He's up for it.
Enthusiastic.
Yeah. I mean, enthusiasm informs the performance as Robin, but not only that. It's just like whatever they gave him to do, he just attacks. Like in the episode that we watched, the Catwoman episode, where they give him a drug to
oh, yeah, and he had to act like, hey, baby.
To make him bad.
It's a swinging time.
He just attacks it. He's game. He's just whatever. You know, just so much energy. He's fun to watch.
Just dives in head first.
And in those early episodes, there's two shots of him, Burton Adam standing side by side as Batman and Robin talking to Commissioner Gordon or mm-hmm. doing whatever they're doing. And it's a struggle for me to decide whose face I want to watch during those shots yeah? because they're both just giving these great facial expressions the whole time. It's genius. But yeah, Burt Ward, I don't know. He doesn't really give I don't know that he gets. I mean, you know, he was the co-star of the show and
yeah.
You know, the set the girls aflame in his day from what I understand. But in the discussions of the show since then, I mean, you hear yeah. Adam West a lot, and rightfully so. But I don't know that Burt Ward gets fully the credit he deserves for being as important as he was to the show, not only as the character was, but as his energy and enthusiasm and game for it all nature.
Yeah. Well, I think because he doesn't. I mean, even though he plays it straight and square,
yeah.
Like Adam West did, I think his enthusiasm. As Dick Grayson and Robin, that gosh, Batman,
yeah.
let's go! You know, I think that carries him a little over the top for some people. Where Batman the whole time is just straight and smooth.
He doesn't get to be cool. Stoic. He doesn't get to be cool like Adam West.
Yeah,
does.
You know, he's the kid, the protege, the you know, okay, George, you know that character. Yeah. But he's the gosh, Batman, you're right. Even though in the first episode he solves all the riddles yeah. before Batman does, yeah. except for one, I think.
Well, and you're right, and I see that for sure. But I think again, it's a deceptive thing that because he's that, it's yeah. easy to dismiss him to a certain extent. But with dismiss him when you're giving out credit, I should say.
Yeah, but, and I think that's what happens.
Or forget him when you're giving out credit.
Yeah, I think that's what happens to the general public.
And I think you're right.
The way they view it.
But without that, the gag doesn't fully work. It's essential.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I was just thinking that that it's the combination of the two is what makes it work.
Right.
There's the balance.
There's a couple of bits. There's a couple of Bruce and Dick bits in the early episodes that just crack me up where... Dick is frustrated because he doesn't want to study French or whatever language he's trying to study for school. And he says, oh, do I really have to study this? And Bruce says, now, Dick, I'm surprised at you. Language, he said, I don't remember exactly what he says, but he says something to the effect of, if we all spoke each other's tongues, it would bring us just that much closer to world peace.
Yeah. And you buy it,
and well, he says,
"Gosh,
it,
Bruce,
he
you're
says
right."
It, and he's all suave,
yeah.
But the cherry on it is Dick saying, "Oh gosh, Bruce, of course you're right." You know, that's yeah. what you need. That the gag doesn't work without it. You know,
yeah.
and his face when he says it is what sells it, though. Like he's genuinely disappointed with himself and resolved that
yeah.
Bruce is right about this whole language is important thing. You know,
and that brings up makes me think of another point too about how. This Batman is a lot like the Adam West Batman. Knows everything. Knows something about everything.
Yeah.
Any subject that comes up, he knows about it. He can do it. He can speak any language that comes up. he can do any thing that needs to be done. Much, and they brought that into the Brave and the Bold cartoon series. That was on recently. That was one of the best Batman cartoons ever, in my opinion. Where what I call the James Bond Batman, where he can do everything, he can do anything, and of course he can. Why? Because he's Batman.
Because he's Batman.
That's the only reason. Because Batman, you know. And the Adam West was like that, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he could speak like this one episode we were watching where he speaks some Spanish to Robin, asks him something I can't remember, and he speaks and he says. Oh, gee, Batman, using your Spanish on me is something. And he's like, yes, Robin, it's important to know. And the same thing.
Yeah.
But he plays it so smooth and so straight that, of course, he knows how to do that because it's because Batman. Now, we went into the villains. We went into... Let's talk about a couple of the other characters. Alan Napier's Alfred. Taking care of Batman and keeping Aunt Harriet in the dark and being the proper British gentleman about it. It kind of set the the standard for everybody thinks Alfred is in Batman, I guess. But I love the episode where, I think it's a Joker episode, where he plays his cousin, who is identical, except without the glasses. And it's a Night Watchman with a thick Cockney accent, more of a gravelly voice. And it's like, oh, Napier, stretching his legs a little bit. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, well, the character, you know, as he appears, is one note, really. But it's, yeah, it's a pleasing note, and I enjoy hearing it, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, he's basically there to for them to sound off of.
Yeah.
When they're Bruce and Dick.
Well, he has his moments where he gets his little fun asides.
Yeah, on his Alf cycle.
Yeah.
And in third season, he's the only person that knows Batgirl is Barbara Gordon.
Yeah.
So that gives her a confidant and a go-between. But Aunt Harriet?
The Aunt Harriet character confuses me. What is the point of her?
The point of her was so people wouldn't make any... say anything about two men or three men living alone in a house together.
Is that what that was?
That's exactly what she was brought in. And she was briefly in the comics for that, too.
Well, she was brought into the comics after the TV show.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. But it was because there was that thing about, you know, Bruce and Dick, they're gay, you know, because they're older man and younger boy, they live together. Yeah, that was a bunch of crap. Not there's anything wrong with that. But that's why I think she was brought in on the TV show, well, from what I recall.
The older man and young boy thing, there's something wrong with that. Let's be clear here. But
well, if you reach a certain age, I mean, you know. But she serves no purpose in the show. Even comic relief-wise, she's weak.
Yeah. Fortunately, she's only in each episode very briefly.
Yeah.
She has just a couple little bit of business to do, and then she's out of the picture. You know?
Yeah. Now, as we move on down the characters... Commissioner Gordon and Chief O'Hara. I love any time they're both on screen.
Yeah.
They, you told me, they play it straighter, especially Gordon.
Yeah.
So, Neil Hamilton.
Yeah.
Plays it straighter than Adam West. He's in a serious movie. He's in a drama.
Yeah.
You know, and God bless him, man. I mean, he sells the Gordon character. And Chief O'Hara with his Irish cop bigorra.
Yeah.
You know,
playing the broadest of broad stereotypes.
He just needed a pint of beer in his hand. It would have been over.
Flask of whiskey.
Yeah, but they are gold anytime that they are on the screen. I love the scenes of them. And especially the ones where Gordon is, and there's other cops or the mayor around him. And as soon as the adventure begins, this is, oh, must be the Penguin again. Do you think you can stop him, Chief O'Hara? What about you,
Captain? Cops,
and they're like,
all the cops are looking at the ceiling. Like,
yeah, and Gordon's like, there's just one thing to do, and they look over at the bat phone.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all look, they all shake their heads like, yes, you're right, Commissioner. Ah, yeah. And he walks over there sternly and picks up the phone like it's a sacred duty. You know, it's amazing. I love seeing them on screen. How about this Blu-ray transfer? Let's talk about.
What's this? Rob and Tony have been at this thing for an hour and 45 minutes. Can they possibly continue? Find out next time.
Same Phantasmo time, same Phantasmo channel.